This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. And before we get started, I want to share a little news with our family of listeners here at The Takeaway. Tanzina Vega, who served as host of this show since 2018 and made history as the first Latina to host it, announced on Friday that she's leaving the show. We wish her all the best in her future projects and endeavors. But don't worry, fam, you're in good hands. The hardworking team of producers, writers, and radio magic makers who bring you The Takeaway are still here. I'm going to fill in as interim host through the end of the year, and together we're going to keep doing our very best to bring you the stories, voices, analysis, and the takeaways that you have come to love. So let's get to our first story. Take a listen to this press conference from March 2020.
WHO has been assessing this outbreak around the clock, and we're deeply concerned both by the alarming levels of spread and severity and by the alarming levels of inaction. We have therefore made the assessment that COVID-19 can be characterized as a pandemic.
Within 2 weeks of that press conference, COVID-19 infections reached 1 million worldwide and claimed more than 100,000 lives. The White House declared a federal state of emergency, and more than 95% of Americans were living under some sort of state or local shelter-in-place order.
California is now under a statewide stay-at-home order.
The hustle and bustle of New York is at a standstill.
New Jersey joined California, New York, Illinois, and Connecticut in ordering residents to stay at home and shuttering non-essential businesses.
Fear is very real for Americans who are now out of work.
Jobs evaporated and American unemployment soared to a record 14.7% by April of 2020. And of course, we now know this was only the beginning. More than a year later, COVID-19 has claimed more than 4.1 million lives globally, including more than 600,000 in this country. Early on, in this context of death and economic devastation, there was one very important action that provided some relief to millions.
In an unprecedented move, the Trump administration announced a temporary national moratorium on evictions for tens of millions of renters who've lost work. The action comes through the Centers for Disease Control, which says that evictions pose a health hazard during the pandemic.
Now, it is not an exaggeration to say that for much of the last 18 months, staying at home was the most important thing that most of us could do to try to save ourselves, our families, and frankly, the world. But how do you stay home without a home? And how do you shelter in place without shelter? By making housing more secure, the eviction moratorium saved lives. But that life-saving but temporary halt in residential evictions is set to expire on Friday. With the end of the moratorium, it's likely that evictions will increase in many American communities almost immediately. On Friday, July 23rd, 1 week before the moratorium is set to expire, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez urged President Biden via Twitter to extend the halt on the evictions by writing, quote, "We must protect the vulnerable and do everything in our power to prevent a mass eviction crisis." We also heard from some of you about the concerns that you have about Friday's looming deadline.
Hi, I'm calling from Washington Heights in Manhattan, New York, New York. I'm terrified. I have been in danger of eviction before. And, you know, my landlord has been very helpful working with me, trying to get paid for back rent through the state and the other opportunities that have been offered by the Fed. But it's just pretty likely that I'll still be about 2 months behind in rent at the end of the month.
We're joined today by Julian Castro, former Secretary of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. Secretary Castro, thank you for being here.
Great to be with you.
And we're also joined by Peter Hepburn, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Rutgers University, Newark, and part of the Eviction Lab at Princeton University. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So, Secretary Castro, I want to begin with you. I know a month ago when the CDC extended the moratorium, you absolutely praised that effort. Here we are once again facing the end of the eviction moratorium. What do you think we ought to be doing next?
Well, I agree with those who have said that the Biden administration should try and extend the moratorium. That's complicated by the decision of the Supreme Court. But what we face right now is an emergency situation that is ongoing, particularly because of the surge in the Delta variant. We have over 7 million households who are behind on rent payments. And 80% of those folks live in areas where the Delta variant is surging. So you have this perfect storm that is brewing of a surging virus and the potential for an evictions crisis. As Peter and the Evictions Lab have documented, you know, you already have hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of evictions that have happened across the country during the pandemic. And this will exacerbate that. So three things. I think the Biden administration should try and extend this. Congress, on an emergency basis, absolutely could extend the moratorium. And also, there are places, there are states, and there are localities where a state or local eviction ordinance is in place, and states and localities need to reevaluate, if they don't have one in place, putting one in place.
It's sort of a three branches of government and federalism story. I feel like you just gave us, Secretary Castro, this idea that we have at least two branches of the federal government that could act here, but we also, in a system of federalism, have governors and localities that could act. Peter, I'm interested to come to you because, as Secretary Castro was just saying, there were people who, despite this CDC moratorium, were in fact evicted during the pandemic. Can you tell us about how those evictions occurred and what you all are seeing now and expecting to happen after Friday?
Yeah, absolutely. So the CDC eviction moratorium has offered remarkable protections to renters nationwide, but it requires that those renters proactively declare their eligibility for coverage. So it requires them to take certain actions, and it still allows landlords to file eviction cases with the courts and to potentially contest their declarations of eligibility. So it still allows these cases to move forward. And there are, in many cases, tenants who simply didn't know about the rights that were available to them under the moratorium, or didn't have the means of proving their eligibility. So we've been tracking eviction filings in six states and 22 additional cities over the course of the pandemic. It's about one in every four renters in the country. And during the period when the CDC moratorium has been in effect, so September 4th of last year through this week, we've seen about 350,000 cases filed in the jurisdictions that we are tracking. And that's a lot of eviction cases, obviously, but it's a kind of a testament to the eviction crisis that existed in this country before the pandemic, that's less than half of what we would normally see during the same period. So there are a lot of cases that have been prevented as a result of the moratorium, and seeing it lifted now, especially when we know that vaccination rates are lowest in the areas that are at greatest risk of eviction, is, as Secretary Castro suggested, both a personal tragedy for those who face the prospect of eviction, but also a public health risk for everyone.
So let's go to that, Secretary Castro. I don't want to pretend that landlords don't exist and don't matter. As we sort of introduced here, not only is there this public health crisis and a continuing and ongoing one, but also an economic crisis, which, as much as we're in a period of recovery, could also come roaring back, with the Delta variant and the continued spread in some areas. If you're a landlord, you also have a right to be made whole as a fiscal matter. What in the world is going on with the dollars that we expected to see to make landlords whole, in part to make the eviction crisis, sort of on the back end of the moratorium, reduced?
And that's an important point, Melissa. You're right. We do have to be concerned about landlords who themselves often are paying on a mortgage How do you ensure that they are made whole, that they're protected, that they don't lose what they have, and they are eligible for protection? At the same time, because of these difficulties in the distribution of funds out there in states, many of the landlords have not received the assistance that they should receive. A lot of that has been bureaucratic red tape in states and localities. Some of it has been recalcitrance among certain states. But we see a similar challenge with landlords that we do with renters. And you know, that's why the White House a few days ago was smart to convene a forum on ensuring that people are protected from eviction and also addressing some of the needs of landlords.
Secretary Castro, stick with me one more beat on this, because I'm also wondering about the difference between homeowners and renters in this COVID moment. So I'll be quite honest, as a homeowner, we got hit pretty hard, you know, in terms of my salary when COVID-19 hit, and we were able to kind of pause our mortgage payments, but those payments just got added to the back end, right? So at some point, 20 years from now, I will pay those, you know, three mortgage payments that I missed and we'll move forward. But that's not how it works for renters, right? When this ends, it's all due day one. Why such a big difference for renters versus homeowners?
Well, you know, the rental assistance that Congress allocated, the program that was put in place, did take into account under certain circumstances for renters, not just back rent, current rent, but future payments as well. So, you know, I would encourage renters who are out there to call their city government, call their housing authority, or perhaps one of the big charities in their area that takes on this challenge, like the United Way or Catholic Charities or others, because what they may find is that they're actually able to access funds that address this. The situation that you're describing, Melissa, is actually a frightening one for so many people out there, because they're $5,000, $6,000 or more behind on rent. And their fear is that the minute that a landlord can begin the eviction process in those states where they haven't yet, or where an eviction can actually happen, that landlord is going to say, hey, where's my $6,000? And they're not going to have that. You know, it's not a matter of $100 or something that they can afford. The good news is that there is the possibility of getting some of those funds that they need, but they, you know, the states and localities need to get better about distributing those resources. My advice for renters would be, you know, you need to be aggressive. Don't sit back.
So, Peter, let me come to you on this. We are, again, looking at this spread of the Delta variant, increases in cases. But even beyond the question of living in a pandemic, aren't evictions always a public health crisis?
Absolutely. I mean, they are, they set up families for a whole string of negative consequences that, you know, hurt individuals, they hurt children, and they hurt communities. And unfortunately, in this country, you know, under normal circumstances, we're seeing, you know, 3.7 million eviction cases filed every year. That's seven eviction cases every minute. We're forcing far too many people to go through this process and to risk losing their homes. And we know that a disproportionate number of those people are Black, they're Latinx, and a disproportionate number of them are women, and in many cases, single mothers. And we're putting this burden, this risk of housing loss on communities that are already facing an array of challenges.
And Peter, if they are women who also are parents, then that's got to mean that there are children being evicted. Can you say a few words about what happens for children in everything from schooling to nutrition to health when they experience an eviction?
Yeah, we know that that kids who are evicted, you know, they face challenges in their educational trajectories, in maintaining access to sufficient food. Often eviction is begins a cycle of housing instability that leads families into suboptimal or subprime housing in worse neighborhoods and more exposure to lead poisoning, to chemical exposure, and a variety of environmental hazards that are bad for kids' development.
So, Secretary Castro, as I'm listening to Peter talk, I'm thinking, you know, so much of what's happened during the pandemic has been these crisis moments, which actually reveal these deep structural inequities that pre-existed COVID-19, but this pandemic has helped us to see them. What are the inequities in our system of maybe affordable housing or of renting or of homeowning in general that have been revealed by this particular eviction crisis?
Well, this just put a big exclamation point on the fact that we had a rental affordability crisis well before this pandemic. There was just another study the other day that showed what a lot of analyses have shown, which is that somebody working minimum wage, for instance, 40 hours a week, a full-time worker, there's not a single county in this country where they can afford the rent on a two-bedroom apartment. And in most places, they can't afford the rent on a one-bedroom apartment. And that's just one example. For so many people in this country, the rent is unaffordable. In addition to that, housing prices have been spiking as well. Again, they were before the pandemic, after the recovery from the Great Recession. So this is an inveterate challenge that requires, I think, for us to summon this sense, this, I hope, collective sense that we've had during the pandemic, that we're all in this together. And I believe see housing as a human right and work in this country to try and make sure that everybody has a safe, decent, affordable place to live going forward. That's going to be more investment. It's going to mean investing in more housing units out there in our country and making sure that they're affordable, accessible to everybody.
Peter, you work on evictions as a matter of intellectual and scholarly work. Is this sort of possibility around housing as a right and an affordable housing, sort of a greater stock of it going forward, does that seem likely or maybe even just possible based on the work that you do?
No, it's encouraging, I think, to see more policymakers at the federal and at the state level taking this seriously and trying to think about what more could be done to support renters in their communities. I think we've seen action at the state level in a number of states that are trying to think about how they could reform the eviction process. One of the big things is that people who are facing eviction don't have the right to a lawyer. It's not guaranteed to them. And the vast majority don't have legal representation, whereas landlords almost always do. And not having a lawyer when you're facing risking your home, often over less than $1,000, is sort of unimaginable. And we're starting to see more states take on legislation that would guarantee the right to counsel in eviction cases. I think that's a very important step, and it would be great to see more states move that way.
Kind of a public defenders for eviction cases?
Exactly. And so Washington State recently did this. A number of other states are in the process of implementing these programs. But those tend to be the states that already had fairly strong renter protections in place. Right. So the states that have more sort of landlord-friendly regulations, places like Texas, for instance, aren't really considering those as options. And in many cases are even moving the regulations to be more landlord friendly. So I think we face this potential divide between states that are fairly safe to be a renter in and where you are better protected from the threat of eviction. And then unfortunately a fairly large number of states that threat is all too real and isn't really changing.
Peter Hepburn is an assistant professor of sociology at Rutgers University, Newark. He's also part of the Eviction Lab at Princeton University. And Julian Castro is the former secretary of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. Secretary Castro, Professor Hepburn, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Now, we've been talking about a potential housing crisis caused by the looming expiration of the CDC eviction moratorium. At the center of this crisis are queer and trans folk, especially in Black and Latino communities in the U.S. South. The Alliance to End Homelessness identified a critical shortage of shelters in the western and southern states a full year before the pandemic even began. And the Atlanta Journal and Constitution conducted a study that found Black tenants living in predominantly Black neighborhoods are most likely to face eviction by aggressive landlords. So take these racial and regional realities and notice that they intersect with the long-term reality that members of LGBTQ communities experience 120% higher risk of homelessness. And in many southern states, it's a common practice to turn away trans folk from shelters for the homeless, especially shelters run by religious organizations.
Most trans people, especially Black trans people and trans people of color, will experience massive barriers to housing, employment opportunities, transportation, access to healthcare, and the ability to obtain gender-affirming identity documentation.
And that is why we've created House of Tulip.
Based in New Orleans, House of Tulip is a nonprofit organization that's buying and restoring multifamily properties to create permanent housing for Black trans people and other trans people of color. During a recent trip to New Orleans, I spent some time with Executive Director Mariah Moore. Mariah invited me to one of the House of Tulip residences, where we were joined by community members and by my 19-year-old daughter, who rode along with me to the interview and who was very impressed.
It's gorgeous in here, mm-hmm. and there's so much space for everyone to like be themselves. Like, mm-hmm. wow.
Now, that reaction is exactly what House of Tulip is going for. Mariah explained,
"We want people, when they walk through the door, if they're feeling down about their life, you know, as I have felt many, many times before, you walk into a place that is welcoming and warm, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. it is of a certain standard, and right. you take pride in it. Like, you're happy to
exactly.
be here.
Exactly.
It's not cold and, you know, facility-like."
Mm-hmm. The house is a classic New Orleans double shotgun. Two people share the unit on the left, and three will ultimately share the three-bedroom unit where we met. The square footage isn't enormous, but the house has two fully renovated bathrooms, high ceilings, an open format kitchen with white cabinets and granite countertops, and it does indeed feel like home.
So it's empty right now, but when they move in, then the refrigerator will be full, mm-hmm. everything will be full. They'll have Visa gift cards, they'll have Winn-Dixie gift cards, they'll have all the nice, beautiful hygiene essentials that we've listened mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and gather for them, mm-hmm. you know, to let them know like we care, mm-hmm. but also just be like, this is your start, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And you'll have what you need, and then we're just going to continue to help you along the way, and we'll pull back eventually and be like, you got this.
Yeah, right.
You know, you yeah. got this, mm-hmm. you know, don't call me for no milk.
But in the beginning, supportive housing extends far beyond the safe, beautiful space to live and a fridge full of food. For Mariah, wraparound care is deeply personal and hands-on.
When the very first person moved in on the other side, they were like, they told me, like, girl, I don't know how to cook anything. And I was like, well, I'm going to come by mm-hmm. on Sunday. I'm going to teach you how to cook fish. Mm-hmm. So I was showing them how to do the fish, and, you know, they were like, I feel so loved. Mm-hmm. You know, because mm-hmm. I was like, you know, pay attention now, you're not, you mm-hmm. gotta, you know, I don't share my recipe, honey. Mm-hmm. They can cook it for themselves, you know, and they're beautiful. Yeah, I mean.
You're like, we brought some loaves, we brought some fishes, next thing you know, the multitudes, yes.
Uh-huh. And I sat on the couch over there and fell asleep because the food was good. I have witnessed so many times in different places that I visited that provide support. People are so policed. It was important to lead with trust.
Leading with trust is a core value guiding the expansive work of the House of Tulip. I asked Mariah about the decision to tackle such an ambitious set of goals, given that House of Tulip is still a young organization with very modest financial resources.
Like, people just kept saying these things like, well, we can't do this, and this is not possible, and oh, well, we're a long way off from that. And, you know, when you heard that all your life and experience that, right, and then also start thinking about some of these phrases are the reasons why I've experienced these disparities, it's like, well, if not me, then who? And then when, right? Like, mm-hmm. when are we going to start saying we can do it? We're going to find a way, mm-hmm. right? We're going to fight harder. We're going to do everything that we need to do. The government mm-hmm. has continuously failed. We can do it. We just choose not to.
For Mariah, the failures of the system are at least in part because it's simply chosen not to take the time or spend the resources necessary to care for the most vulnerable. House of Tulip is working hard to make different choices. And of course, none of this means that communal living environments made possible by the House of Tulip are free of challenges or discord. Still, rather than adhering to a policy of zero tolerance or threatened expulsion, Mariah and her team lead with trust, which means beginning with conversation.
So, you know, of course, we come by regularly. We check in, you know, we sit down and talk and, you know, people communicate what they need or if they're having conflict, which we've had some conflict between some of our community members. But we just say, hey, we have to work this out.
And this strategy of beginning with conversation and trust is foundational for Mariah's understanding of how we solve many social problems.
We have to ask ourselves, was it the moment that we stopped knowing our neighbors that we started experiencing more crime? Was it the disinvestment of community and community support where we started to feel insecure and unsure about our safety when we walked out of our front door?
Walking out the front door and knowing the neighbors is not just rhetoric. Mariah took me around the neighborhood where we chatted with several members of the community.
Hello there.
Hello.
How you doing? I'm Mariah Moore.
How you doing?
I'm good.
Oh, so you doing house calls. You popping up.
Oh, yes. I'm popping up. I'm popping up. I'm coming by. I want to see. I'm trying to see what the vibe going to be. You been getting what you need to take care of yourself?
Trying
to. What are some of the things that you think you need or you know you need?
During our time together, I listened as Mariah repeatedly asked the question, what do you need? And she also asked, what would you change if you could?
I really don't know. It's a lot. I know crime is one thing, mm-hmm. but more power in like black hands. It's not really dispersed evenly. It's more one-sided. So,
given representation.
Giving us the ability to make changes in our neighborhood.
This young man's message of change resonated with Mariah, and frankly, with all of us who were walking along with her on that afternoon. He asked for more power in the hands of black folk so that communities can make changes in their own neighborhoods. And it is precisely this idea which underlies the work of Mariah Moore and the House of Tulip.
These hands, our people's hands who are inherently gifted, right?
Mariah Moore is executive director of House of Tulip. Last week, she also became a political candidate for the very first time when she qualified to run in a crowded primary to represent District D on the New Orleans City Council. Now, we here at The Takeaway would love to hear from you about the ways you're using your hands to make a difference in your community. What challenges have you identified, and how have you organized to make a difference? Call us at 877-869-8253. Or record a voice memo and email it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Welcome back to The Takeaway, where we're indulging in a bit of nostalgia. Yes, those are the voices of the Marvelettes singing Please, Mr. Postman. In 1961, this single became the first Motown tune to hit number one. And it's the sweet story of a girl waiting to hear from her guy. Not by text, tweet, or Snapchat, but by waiting for a letter. In the decade that followed the release of this song, thousands of American families waited for the postman. hoping for word from their sons and their beaux who were serving in Vietnam. Mail has kept us connected in love and in war. Indeed, the Postal Service is so fundamental to who we are as a nation that the founders established the Postal Service before they even signed the Declaration of Independence. That's a fact we're reminded of in Winifred Gallagher's stunning 2017 text, How the Post Office Created America. In that book, Gallagher writes, quote, "With astonishing speed, the Post established the United States as the world's information and communications superpower." Nearly 250 years later, the Post remains a vital organ in the nation's central nervous system. You talked to us about what it meant to you as well.
My name is Ruth Miali. I'm calling from Lawrence Township, New Jersey. Post office means to me, it's one of the last threads of universal community that and service that we share in this country. I can count on communicating with someone this way more reliably than any other. This is one essential social and community glue that I really, really value and would hate to see go or diminished or even kept at the diminished level of funding that it's at now. We talk about improving communities. This is already here.
Hi, my name is Allegra Fusick. I'm calling from Sacramento, California. And the Postal Service is very important to me. It's how I communicate with my rural friends and family. I mail care packages and letters for the older folks to read. They don't have internet access, and receiving real mail that they can hold in their hands is very important to them. It's how they pay their bills. They have no other alternative.
Hi, this is Gail from San Rafael, California. The post office is important to me because I get my medicine by mail. I vote by mail. I shop and make returns by mail. And I love my local postal workers. They're the best.
My name is Kyle Franklin, and I'm calling from Seattle, Washington. A handwritten note is so much more meaningful than an email or even a printed letter. The post office allows me to connect with friends and loved ones near and far to show I care through its services.
Now, it's pretty clear from your calls that the Postal Service is a big part of your lives. But the USPS is far from healthy. Findings from the Government Accountability Office, or GAO, found that the Postal Service lost $87 billion over the last 14 fiscal years. So, back in March, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy proposed a 10-year strategic plan to address the fiscal problems. Now, the plan includes cutting post office hours and extending so-called service standards. The changes would significantly delay mail delivery for most households and businesses. This month, the Postal Regulatory Commission released an opinion of the strategic plan, finding that, quote, the new standards will not result in much improvement, if any, to the Postal Service's current financial condition. In short, it says, the post office is broke, and DeJoy's plan won't fix it. With me now to discuss the history and future of the U.S. Postal Service is Phil Rubio, professor of history at North Carolina A&T State University and author of Undelivered, From the Great Postal Strike of 1970 to the Manufactured Crisis of the U.S. Postal Service. Welcome to The Takeaway, Professor Rubio.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
So let's start with kind of the back end of the title of your book. Why do you say that the current Postal Service crisis is manufactured?
Well, the post office has always been a contradiction. You know, it's beloved, as you say, but and it's always been a fundamental part of our democracy. But on the other hand, internally, it's been authoritarian and autocratic and been low wage. It's also been unionized. So for years, the post office was trying to cut labor costs, especially at the turn of the century. And using that as a way of keeping costs down. And Congress increasingly became anxious about the annual deficit and how the post office itself by the 1960s was not able to keep up, its infrastructure was not able to keep up with growing volume. So there grew this idea of creating a hybrid. It actually started in the Johnson administration. And then when Nixon was elected president, that's what he and his postmaster general really tried to push, was creating a hybrid, a postal corporation, okay, that would no longer be in the cabinet, which it had been since 1829, but instead it would be self-supporting. And meanwhile, postal workers had won partial collective bargaining rights, and they were really becoming restive over the fact that their wages had lagged behind and they didn't have full collective bargaining rights. Give you an idea of how low their wages were. Starting pay on the eve of the strike in 1970 was $6,100. Top pay after 21 years was $8,400. That's almost $2,000. Well, that's $1,500 below the median family income. And they could see that the legislation was moving through that Nixon was demanding in 1969. A postal corporation, they were afraid they were going to lose their civil service benefits. And he was going to refuse to pay them their annual raise because not just operations, but postal wages came through Congress. So he was essentially holding their raises hostage. And a strike broke out in New York City where you had a lot of strikes in the 60s. So what that does with Nixon is it forces him, that wildcat strike, it forces him to see how much power the postal workers have and that he has to negotiate with them and to reboot his idea of a postal corporation. What you wind up with is a compromise. And what they created was a conundrum, okay? It's both government agency and business.
The post office, right? And I think it's important that we sort of point this out for folks who may not quite understand how it operates, that when I talk about that deficit that it has, that deficit is related mostly to paying, you know, what was finally established by that strike, right? These decent kinds of not so much wages, but really the retirement benefits. But the post office itself, right, receives no direct taxpayer funds. Is that right?
Correct. 1982 was the last time that the post office took any taxpayer funds, which is what Congress was trying to do besides, you know, get politics out of the post office. They didn't want to be on the hook for appropriations or for daily operations. The trouble was they created this institution that's autonomous, but it also doesn't have any real power. And that it's expected to provide universal service, you know, that it's mandated to do that, while also being self-supporting. Self-supporting is not in the Postal Reorganization Act of 1970. That is a myth that Nixon floated at the time, and it's still floated today by Postmaster General DeJoy.
So help us understand also then how it's governed. So we have a new president. Why can't he simply pick a new Postmaster General?
Okay. So according to the Postal Reorganization Act, this Board of Governors was what governs activities of the Postal Service. They are the ones who appoint the Postmaster General, which they did. There was a Republican majority. They're all appointees of the Board of Governors, and they're mainly from, they mostly have corporate backgrounds. So Biden cannot fire him. In the past, this was like a cabinet position. So imagine if a president could not appoint their own Secretary of State or Secretary of Defense. But I want to, if I could, go back to just how things changed and how we got to this manufactured crisis that you asked about a minute ago, which is that, so there's the expectation that the Postal Service will be self-supporting and provide universal service at reasonable rates, and will also provide full union benefits, full collective bargaining. So you had postal workers staying longer, making it a career, being more productive. There was a lot of hostility from conservative forces who are now concerned by the end of the 20th century that the post office was not going to be able to keep up with its pension fund. The Government Accountability Office warned that they weren't going to be able to replenish that fund. But what actually happened when the Office of Personnel Management looked in 2002, they found that the Postal Service had overpaid something like $71 billion into that fund. And because the federal government was using the Postal Service at that point as a cash cow, right? Because postal revenue was generated by the Postal Service, but that was being used to help balance the budget. If the Postal Service now is going to ask for that money back or not contribute any more annual payments, that could send the federal budget into a deficit, $36 billion by 2014.
Professor Rubio, help me to understand, because you've given us the long history, just bring us to this current moment. How has coronavirus and COVID-19 really impacted this crisis, even if it's a manufactured one, in the context of the Postal Service?
Right. So I argue in my book that it was a manufactured crisis that started us on this road to postmasters general attempting cutbacks and even instituting cutbacks, and the rationale being that we can't afford to keep the service at this level that we are. But with COVID, that really exploded this conundrum of business and service that the Postal Service has been trying to maintain. When the Postal Service, the previous Postmaster General, Megan Brennan, announced in April of 2020 that the Postal Service could run out of cash that fall, because of COVID, because of loss of volume and because of a loss of business.
So at this point, is there anything that Americans can take as kind of a bright spot in what's happening? Is there any good that can come out of this?
Well, yes, I think it's forced an accounting of what is it that we expect from our Postal Service? Do we really want to ditch this 246-year-old institution, that your callers so eloquently were speaking to, because what's trending downward is personal correspondence? The Postal Service can't just respond to trends. Policies in the past have been able to influence trends and also innovate and adapt. So the fact that you have people, postal consumers and postal unionists demanding change, writing into the Postal Regulatory Commission, which I think influenced their criticism of Postmaster General DeJoy. The fact that you have people calling for, the Postal Service to be allowed to innovate. And incidentally, before we finish, I wanted to go back to that first, to the intro song you played, "Wait a Minute, Mr. Postman," was written by an African-American postal worker, written by a letter carrier, the one that the Marvelettes record in 1961. And so that the post office isn't just nostalgic, it has a past which should inform our future. The fact that 209,000 postal workers were angry enough to risk their jobs and their livelihoods to go on strike, and that 61% of the public supported them in 1970, that changed the post office to the Postal Service, but also created this conundrum. It's encouraging to me to see that the legacy of that is in strong postal unions and now coalitions with consumers, of people who want to preserve that service and expand it into the future, for all the things that we need it for mail-in balloting, for medications, for personal correspondence, for checks. Our democracy still relies on it.
Indeed. Phil Rubio, author of Undelivered, From the Great Postal Strike of 1970 to the Manufactured Crisis of the U.S. Postal Service, and professor of history at North Carolina A&T State University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for today's show, y'all. But before we go, I want to leave you with my final take for today. On Friday, Tenzina Vega announced she's stepping down as host of The Takeaway. She led this show since 2018 and made history as the show's first Latina host. I know many of you began first tuning into The Takeaway to hear Tenzina's unique take on issues of politics, inequality, and identity. I know, because I'm one of those listeners. And I'm grateful to Tenzina and to this great team of producers for introducing me as a loyal listener to so many wonderful guests and important issues. I wish her absolutely all the best in every personal and professional opportunity that emerges next. Now, during the next 6 months, The Takeaway will look for a new permanent host. But don't worry, we're not going to leave you hanging. During that time, I'm honored to continue in the role of interim host, and I'll be working with the talented team of The Takeaway to bring you the stories, perspectives, and voices you'll only get here. And we're going to need you to keep making your voices heard by calling, texting, and tweeting us to share your ideas and feedback. Heck, after our post office conversation, maybe we even need to get y'all to send us some good old-fashioned letters. If you missed anything, or if you want to listen back, always check out our podcast anywhere you get your audio, or check out thetakeaway.org. And of course, call us about your show ideas at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry saying thank you to Tanzina Vega. And this is The Takeaway.